Blog Talk Radio.
Excursion, moving away from yourself, like a family reunion, finding spirit well, making moral decisions, so good for your health. What joyful occasion when love doesn't have to go. Stone.
Well, Paula asked me what we should play, so I'm beginning to think that Paula is kind of like a DJ now. Were you a DJ in a past life, Paula?
No.
Sure? Because I'm just thinking you queuing up the records. You got the rock and roll going. You're sitting there in the studio. I could just imagine it all. I could just imagine, Paula Thompson here on the Rock of Boulder or wherever you are. You're just all about rock and roll, man. Well, we are rocking and rolling here on the Cosmic Citizen this morning. We're going to have a very interesting show today. One I really look forward to because it's going to allow me to share some personal experiences I've had that I don't know if a lot of our audience knows about, and we invite your calls today. It's an open phone segment, 646-716-8158. That's 646-716-8158. What we're going to discuss here shortly is it's going to be open phones, but it's going to be a specific kind of open phone segment. We are going to ask you what personal obstacles you've encountered as you've chosen to embrace the teachings of the Urantia Book. Have you encountered opposition from your family, maybe from churches? Have you felt the need to be in the closet, as I have to some extent, about my involvement with the book? We look forward to your calls. But before we do that, we have with us a special guest, Diane LeBrecq, who we have on periodically to talk about the Urantia Family Festival, which she is going to be hosting this summer in Montreal. And Diane, welcome again to the Cosmic Citizen.
Yes, thank you so much for having me on board again.
Oh, you're welcome. Diane, you've got some interesting new developments that are happening in the Urantia Family Festival in terms of people that will be there and awards that you're giving out and that kind of thing. Why don't you tell our audience a little bit about that?
Yes, with great pleasure, Andre and Paula, because we are so full of joy. The whole team, the Urantia family team, we are so elated about that. Well, first of all, I do want to reiterate that we are going to have you, our beloved Andre, at the Urantia family. I think the listeners remember that I had mentioned you are going to do a recording of a program in Montreal. So I look forward for the family to be witnessing that. And then we also know that Pato Benton is going to be, our beloved Pato is going to be in concert opening the Urantia Family Festival. So that's really, really great. And we remember that we're going to be just about two street corners from the world-famous Montreal Jazz Festival. So I don't need to say that we're going to be amongst a big crowd of people. And the beauty is that Pato's concert is going to be outside on the street, not inside the room at the university where we will be meeting, but it will be outside in the backyard of the garden so that people, passers-by, can stop. And if they see us, enjoy and ask, hey, what's happening, we can say, oh, you don't know about the Urantia book? Oh, you have the whole weekend to come and visit, and it won't cost you anything. We'll be happy to inform you about it. So it promises to be a very beautiful event. This week, I also received a confirmation from the president of the foundation, Mo Siegel, who's confirmed his presence with other members of the foundation. And Mo was so great as to offer to do a presentation on behalf of the foundation. So we really look forward to have Mo with us. And then also Gaétan Charland. You remember you had Gaétan as your guest.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, so Gaétan is going to be with us. Then there's going to be, there's going to be beautiful awards offered, modeled upon our Divine Father, Son, and Spirit, the Divine Trinity. And so it will be, we know that the Spirit is expressed through ministry. So it will be the public ministry award or recognition. And then for the Son, it will be the Jesusonian Award or recognition, and it will be based on living the teachings of Jesus. And the first one, representing the Father, as we know, the Father gives personality, and the Father is love. So it will be the all-around loving personality recognition. And that, Andre and Paula, is beautiful because as we were having our conference call with the team, someone mentioned on the phone that, on Skype actually, mentioned the fact that that person said, you know, it's really nice because when there is recognition offered, presented to people, it tends to make people strive to be better, to perfect ourselves, just like Jesus said, you know, be you perfect as my Father in heaven is perfect. And so it's always, I remember as a little girl at school, it was always great, you know, to see recognitions and to strive maybe to reach that next one, you know. So at the Urantia family, we will do the same thing, recognize some people for their work. It doesn't mean that they are better than others, but it does mean that they do great loving service. And so it will be wonderful, and I will announce at the inaugural this summer that the next one in 3 years, in 2013, the next family gathering or celebration, the people that will be awarded will have been chosen throughout the 3 years by the Urantia readers around the world that will send in their suggestions and say, hey, you know, for public ministry, have you considered this person or that person? And then it will present itself. It will be so beautiful. And then the person, the recipients that will have received it this year will be the ones to pass on the baton, you know, just like in the Olympics when you pass the flame or the torch. So they will pass the torch on to the next Urantians that will be recognized or presented those awards. And I think it will be so beautiful. We also have Jay Peregrine from the foundation who's going to give us a great presentation on all the translations that have been done so far. I also got the confirmation that Chris Harvison, you remember Chris, your guest?
Course.
Oh, we love Chris. Chris is going to be with us to do a presentation. So we have an incredible amount of interesting people. We have registrations that people can do right on site. We've also extended the early bird registration until the 31st of January, and we got a great response from that. Can I give the link if people want to know more about it?
Absolutely.
Okay, it's very simple. It's called the United Urantia Family Festival. So the acronym is TUUFF.org. And they can get all the information on that. They can also go on urantiafamily.org. Those are the two websites. And they can register. They can pre-register. We've even made a nice a format to offer people just to pay for the deposits, so it freezes the early bird price, and they can only pay the one in, 120, so that it will guarantee their presence, and then in a month or two, they can pay another $100, and then the same thing in another 2 months, so that by the end of the period when the conference starts, they will have paid their presence in a very slow way so that it's affordable for everybody's budget. So we're getting a great response. A lot of people have registered so far, and we're very happy. We welcome everyone. It's the inaugural of a Urantia family receiving readers from all organizations everywhere. We're brothers and sisters, and it's great. We have people from the foundation, from the association, from the fellowship, from the unaffiliated, from the independent readers, and we will celebrate our Urantia family spirit all together in beautiful Montreal.
I'm just sitting here imagining all this and just thinking about how much fun I'm going to have. In addition to doing our show, from the festival, I want to do a lot of different little mini interviews like I did at the last summer festival as well. And
yes.
We have our good friend Mark Erickson is going to be recording those for me, and I really look forward to that. I think we're going to have a lot of stuff we can play back on the air.
Yes, great. Mark is already registered, and we're also going to have a night out, so we will all together go see the World Fireworks Contest, which includes like many countries around the world, China, Japan, United States, Canada, Europe, Australia, everywhere. And it's quite an event. Actually, Jay Peregrine, I think, knew about it, and he said he was very impressed when he saw it before. So we will be real close to that. We can also go on a cruise to see the fireworks. We also have the choice to go see the Montreal Jazz Festival. We're going to have a pajana, how do we call that? Pajama night, you know, when you watch a movie in pajama with popcorns
and
chips.
A slumber party or pajama party or something.
A pajama party, yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So it's going to be, we have a banquet, we have a nightclub dance evening, so it's going to be really beautiful, and we're also going to pay attention to the children and the youth on Monday. Monday will be completely devoted to the children. And so that will be very beautiful. It promises to be one great Urantia family gathering.
Wow.
Well, and I have to say that Montreal is just the most beautiful city. I love Canada. I've been to several cities in Canada now, Vancouver and Ottawa and Montreal, Quebec. And we were there. The Urantia Book Fellowship had a conference in outside of Montreal in St. Hyacinthe in 1993, and Diane was the MC for that conference. And my whole family went, and we spent our free day in Montreal, and we toured all around. And what a beautiful city! I was there for a site meeting, and it was an international kite festival. I've never seen anything like that. So it's an amazing city that just has wonderful events. And just to be in Montreal would be treat enough, but let alone, say, have a wonderful United Urantia Family Festival.
And, you know, we were so lucky. It must be a godsend or something, because we are going to be staying at the University, UQAM, right downtown Montreal. I could not believe that we were able to reserve the site at the university right around the Montreal Jazz Festival, because what the listeners have to know is that Montreal turns into one celebrating city for 2 months, two full months, June, July until August. The city turns into a festival, a festival, a festival city. So day after day, nonstop, for 2 months, week after week, is the jazz festival, the fireworks festival, the flower festival, the African music festival, the movie festival, and the city turns into, just for Laugh Festival, it turns into a welcoming platform for people from all over the world. And we're going to be, if you play, you know, that dart game, if you try to aim at the dead bullseye center, that's where we're going to be, right downtown Montreal on the main street. It's like being on Fifth Avenue in New York. We're going to be on St. Catherine at the corner of St. Denis, and it's going to be buzzing of energy. So can you imagine Pato singing outside and having people pass by and say, "What is this concert all about? You mean you don't know Pato Benton?" And then, you know, entering into conversation with people. I can just foresee, I hope and pray that Pato can be part of the jazz festival as well. It would be just a cherry on the cake. But so it's going to be wonderful to be right there. We don't have, everything is at walking distance. We don't have to drive or go anywhere, and we will be one big family celebrating together.
Wow, that's wonderful.
Yes. Correct. Yes.
And thank you for all of your work on this, Diane. We know how hard it is to pull
something. It's a lot of work, but it's a passion. It's done with so much love. I live it day in, day night. I'm in bed. I think about it. It's just part of me. I'm already living.
I have to show you where my mind is going. Since I love food, I know there's going to be food there. But I know you're going to have some. How are the meals? You're going to have some planned meals, and then some other times when we're eating out. Is that the way it works? Or
yes, actually, very good question, Andre. And it's even better than this. I've reserved an actual restaurant that's going to be reserved for us. A private. We will have our own private restaurant.
Oh my gosh.
With a terrace. And it will be close to the public and open just for us for 5 days. And it's right on the site of the university, and it's right on St. Catherine Street. And it's got a little inside terrace, outside terrace, and we will have our meals. So the meals are included in the price, our breakfast and lunch, like a full lunch with three choices.
Sure.
And then the supper is left open to people because we should mention that all the rooms have little kitchenettes so that at night, if people want to buy a box of cereal and some milk and just have a light supper or a sandwich or something, they can do that. If they want to gather with their friends, because now we're going to have readers from the fellowship, readers from the association, readers from everywhere, I can't wait to meet my brothers and sisters that I've never met before, you know. And so if they want to gather together and go for a pizza on the street, you know, and be 10 together, hey, let's go to this restaurant, there's going to be restaurants galore, you know. So we thought that at night it would be nice to leave it open.
Walking distance, right?
Oh, it's yes, it is.
Wow.
I mean, walking distance, you know. So it's going to be wonderful. And the restaurant being just for us, we will be able to have that very, very intimate atmosphere.
Absolutely.
Which I think will create memories that will last for
years and years.
That's
wonderful.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much, Dan. Thank you so much again for give us the link again to the site for people who still want to register, since they still have some time to pre-register.
Yes, with pleasure. www.tuuff.org, and people can get right on the site, register, get the information, and we can't wait to see them, everybody. Thank you so much.
It sounds like a love fest.
It is. It is. It actually is. God is love, and the Urantia family is love, and we have to learn to live and love one another and accept our differences. And it's not going to be a political celebration. It's going to be a united Urantia family celebration.
Absolutely.
So we will unite in the spirit of love and see how we can grow together harmoniously around the world, be informed of all the projects. We have Sue Tennant with her beautiful free school project, literacy project. Derek has promised to come and inform us. Pradana from South America with his Patagonia mission. It's going to be one beautiful celebration and yet informing ourselves of everything that's going around with the Urantia Revelation.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Thank you so much.
Diane, before you leave, can you tell us just briefly one thing that you have found that has been a real challenge for you, you faced in embracing the teachings of the Urantia book?
One challenge? Okay, I'm not sure that I understand you clearly, Paula.
Well, our show, Diane, today is going to be about what personal obstacles we've encountered or challenges we've encountered in sharing. I think what Paula is saying, and I'm sorry, correct me if I'm wrong, Paula, you're saying if you could give us a little of your own personal testimony on that. Is there anything that you encountered that has been a challenge for you in your embrace of the Urantia book?
Well, actually, thank you for asking me for one reason, because when you did mention this at the beginning of the show, there's a memory that flashed back in the forefront of my mind, and I do remember, like you all know by now, I think the world will know that I come from a large family of 12 people, but I'm just saying this because when I discovered the Urantia book, my family thought I was in a sect. And being the different child of the family, it was like, oh my God, what is she into now? Where did she get it? Oh, that Diane, you know? And so they thought I was in this big sect or whatever. And you mentioned IC93 Pala in St. Hyacinthe in Montreal. And so I had invited my family to come. And because we had a special celebration, they all came up. The whole 12 of them, well, not just 12, because the husbands and the wives and, you know, and this and that. And so they came, and they were expecting, like, this sect and this weird and bizarre thing or whatever.
Like a cult. Like a cult, you mean?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
A sect, you know, a cult. Okay, thank you. I guess I was saying it in French. A cult. And so they all thought I was part of a cult, and they were scared to lose me and all this. And then they came to IC, they came to Montreal at IC93, and I was all new. This was only 12 months old involvement for me with the Urantia Revelation. And then they looked at me, and after a while, they said, "What?" I will always remember my beloved sister Linda. She said, "Diane, what is it with all of you guys? I mean, where do you take this? You're all so joyful and smiling. Is it a pill? Is it what? You seem so joyful, so happy, you know, and there's a spirit of fraternity and brotherhood, like love is flowing." I thought it was so beautiful, you know, because at first they were all scared to lose me to a cult, and by the time they left, they said, "My God, I don't know what you guys are reading. We don't know anything about it, but it sure works because there's one spirit of love in the air." And so it was nice because they saw that it's when you live it, when you express it, that, you know, the proof is in the pudding, as they say. So when they saw the kind of love that I was expressing to them and compassion or empathy or non-judgment or whatever, they started to look at it without judgment, because I realized, you know what, we judge from fear. It's the fear of the unknown. And out of self-protection, we want to protect our world, our entity, our identity, and so we don't want to be destroyed by others who are threatening to us. And because of that, we judge, we attack, we say, "No, I don't want to know." But when we do find out, then we say, we bring down the defense, and we say, "Oh, maybe I could listen to you." And by listening, they gain, you know, and they gain to know that it's absolutely beautiful. And since then, I've offered the book to my sister, my beloved, my confidant, Marie Carole, and it has brought us so close that we are soul, we are connected right at the fabric of our souls, and it's all because of the Urantia Revelation. So I do understand what people go through, and to me it's only fear, and when you forget about the fear, and love goes through everything, it permeates everything. And then people just listen to you, and you can just bathe in that love, and the fear goes.
Diane, Larry on the board, and before I go on, Andre, some of the folks on the board are asking you to, if you can pump up the volume a little bit. On
okay,
your
I will do that. I will be very close to the phone. Okay.
And Diane, Larry wants to know how you found the book. Do you have another minute to tell us how you found the book?
Well, to be really honest, if I have to speak the truth, it would be much more than 5 minutes. So I would prefer to wait because it was, I'm very touched to be asked this, but at the same time, I must be truthful to myself. And there's a beautiful story about it. And I don't want to take up the time of your listeners. You have such a great show. So maybe
well, you know
some
what,
other
Diane,
time, or maybe at the festival.
At some point, what we'll do is we'll do a show specifically on how people found the Urantia book, and you could be one of three guests or four guests, and we can give you a good 20 minutes or whatever to talk, or half an hour to talk about that, and maybe that's what we'll do. We'll have personal testimonies. How there's actually a book
that's
about that.
That's a great idea.
You know, actually,
I just feel like being respectful to Jesus
on how it was
presented to me, and it is not something to be said lightly, you know.
Right.
So.
Well, there's actually a book. I think it was put out by Square Circles called "How I Found the Urantia Book," and
yes.
that is a that's
yes.
very interesting. You know.
Yes.
that's an interesting one. So, well, thank you again for being with us, Diane. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We all look forward to being there, and it just sounds like it's going to be a very joyful occasion.
Yes, we love you, and we thank you so much for Cosmic Citizen. What
love
a great
you
show.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Bye, Paula.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Andre.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.
That was Diane LeBuck, who is just been a longtime reader from Montreal, who is doing the Urantia Family Festival in Montreal. So on to our topic here. Paula, I'm sorry, I've been talking a little too much here, so I'm going to let you have some words here. Tell me, you know, maybe I should ask you this question. I mean, I know that what's the word I'm looking for? You've been out, you know, doing a lot. You've been involved in outreach work for the last couple of decades, at least, and you know, with the Urantia book. And what kind of obstacles have you encountered personally as you've tried sharing the Urantia book with people, or if are there people that you haven't been able to talk to about the book that you'd like to be able to share that part of your life with, or what's happened with you?
Well, you know, I'll just start with the first real door getting slammed in my face, big time. And, I mean, you know, I think we all go through difficulties with our family to varying degrees. My family, they're not judgmental. They're very kind-hearted people, and so they kind of rolled their eyes, you know. And later I was able to turn my whole family on, but I wasn't able to do it. It was because I got my oldest sister, Sharon, to read the book, and I didn't even turn her on to it. I gave it to her son, my nephew, who's 8 years younger than me, on his 18th birthday, and he took it home, and his mom found it and started to read it. And because my sister, who is the oldest in my family and so level-headed, just was blown away by this book, then my whole family went, wow, there might be something to this. So it wasn't really me who turned you know, them on. It was her, just by the fact that, you know, I'm the baby of the family, but she's the oldest. And so, you know, if we both like it, and especially if she likes it, gee, there must be something to it. So I'm delighted to say that my mom went on to the, you know, graduated knowing the Jesus of the Urantia book. And when my dad died, she got very mad at God and very mad at Jesus. And so it was a real catharsis for her, a real healing. But this happened in about 1983, and I had been reading the book for 7 years at the time, and just started to dabble in you know, kind of, because, you know, you get various reactions from people. Of course, I tried to tell my friends about it and my family, as I said, but, you know, I wasn't having any luck at all. I mean, here was this, the most frustrating thing in the world is to have found this amazing revelation of truth. I mean, it just rocked my world, and I wanted to share it with everybody. I'm an altruistic person. If I find something that good, I can't not want to share it. And to have people just be so laissez-faire about it and just nonplussed and not interested, and, you know, and they think you're crazy or you're a lunatic because, you know, you can't tell them who wrote it. And, you know, it's just, we've all experienced these things. I know we have. And so you get kind of, you get disillusioned at first. And in about 1983, I started doing more public outreach, and I decided, you know what, I'm not going to apologize for it. I'm just going to tell people straight up, you know, I believe this thing. This thing is amazing to me. And, you know, take a look at it. Just decide for yourself. And we moved to a new house, and there was a woman who lived down the hill from me, fundamental Christian. We hadn't been there but a week, and her husband came up and wanted to get us into Christian marriage counseling. And Glenn,
okay.
And I, we had to laugh because, you know, we weren't even married yet.
Wow.
And just kind of looked at each other like, okay, thanks. You know, that was the response we had, Andre. Okay. So, she was very much wanting to get me to come to this evangelical church in the canyon. It's called The Chapel in the Hills. And but she didn't come right out and say that. But she worked on me just the same. And she called me up one day and she said, would you like to go for a horseback ride? And I had a horse. And she said, we're going to ride up in the meadow. I'm going to ride up in the meadow. Would you like to come? And I said, I'd love to come, Carolyn. And I had my little son, my four-year-old son, Nathan, with me. And me and Nate were riding the horse together. He was sitting on the front of the saddle with me. And I saddled up everything, caught my horse, saddled up, took it down to Carolyn's house. She was just right below me. And we were getting ready to go, and up rides the pastor. And he's a stocky, fiery little man, and he has a stocky, fiery little horse. And he comes trotting up, and Carolyn looks at me real sheepishly and says, oh, by the way, I asked the pastor to come. And I'm like, oh, great, here we go. And I said, that's fine, Carolyn, that's great. So me and Nate, because I had my little boy with me, we're kind of plodding along at the back. And Pastor is up front on his horse, you know. He's like the general leading the charge, you know. And his horse is always at a fast trot. And I'm fine. It's a beautiful day, beautiful summer day. And pretty soon the pastor pulls the reins and drops back and is riding along next to me. And he says, so, Paula, do you believe Jesus died for your sins? And I swallowed really hard. And this is where the rubber meets the road, friends. You know, I hadn't had enough experience talking to Christians at the time to know exactly what I said, what to say that would be diplomatic. And so I just said what I really thought. I said, well, no, Pastor, I don't. I don't believe he died for my sins. I believe that he lived for me. And I cling to every word of truth he ever spoke. That is my salvation. I honestly don't believe he had to die. Well, surely you know, and you can imagine what happened. I mean, He immediately went into theology mode, and he was shocked and appalled that I would say that to begin with, and was pulling out every best argument he had. And the Bible, the next word, of course, is the Bible says this. And I said, well, you know, actually, the Bible is not my religious book. It's not the book that I base my faith on. I base my faith on a book called the Urantia Book. Well, that was it. I mean, you might as well have said that I was green.
Sacrificing babies.
yes, exactly. Yeah. And really, I mean, he was like so not interested in me at all anymore. He trotted back up to the front of the line, said something to Carolyn. She turned back and gave me a look that would kill. And you can imagine how frosty this day out with the pastor and Carolyn was. Wow. We got to the meadow. We all got off our horses. We took out our lunches. Carolyn and the pastor wouldn't even talk to me. They would barely even look at me. And, you know, got through that, got back down, you know, because this is a long, old mining road all the way up to the top of a mountain. So it was a long, frosty ride after that. And got home. Carolyn would not associate with me, never again said a kind word to me. And, in fact, nobody in the canyon who went to that church was allowed to associate with me after that, nor were they allowed to associate with my children. Mm. And there were a lot of people in that neighborhood that went to that church, and they all had children, and their children were not allowed to play with my children. I had just moved there. We lived there for 23 years.
Wow.
fortunately, there was other people in the canyon who did not go to the little chapel in the hills, and they were, you know, their children could play with my children, and, you know, we had friends up there. But as far as that church was concerned, we were of the devil. And it was a very sad thing. Very sad. Because
well, it's really, it is sad, particularly because, Paula, because, you know, Jesus met the same, you know, that's the oldest trick in the book. You know, Jesus met the same resistance. You know, I mean, people told him the same thing. They said, you know, how can Satan, when he would cast out demons, they told him he was using the power of demons to cast demons out. And he said, you know, what did Jesus say? He said, well, how can that be possible? He said, a house divided against itself cannot stand. You know, how can Satan cast out Satan? So in the same way, how can this Urantia book, which speaks against Lucifer and speaks against Satan, how can it be from the devil? You know, but you know, this is, I think, what happens when new revealed truth comes out, we encounter resistance. And that's kind of what I think, part of what we're going to be discussing today is the resistance we encounter. And, you know, just what you were saying to me, Paul, just reminds me, you know, what do we do? And here I go using the word we again, but in this case I think it's an important, what do we do when we encounter Christians who talk about the cross? You know, I mean, now I think, you know, I think what I try to do now is instead of just talking about, instead of saying, no, I don't believe in blood atonement, maybe saying something like, you know, I believe Jesus showed his love to us on the cross when he said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. You know, you meet truth with truth, or you meet what they say with truth. I'm sorry. And, you know, instead of firing fire with fire, you fight it with water, you know. But that's something, you know, that's one of those charming, gracious techniques that takes us a while sometimes to internalize and to absorb. And I understand that you were a young reader at the time, and maybe that just didn't occur to you at the time.
Well, no, it caught me totally off guard. A, I didn't know the pastor was going to be riding with us. B, I didn't know that he was going to, you know, in other words, Carolyn literally brought out the big guns. I didn't have a chance to prepare. I see it as a dirty trick.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. She should have told you the pastor was coming along right away and asked you if that was okay.
Yeah, and she didn't. She knew. She had a purpose, and the purpose was to kind of rope me in. And I'm not a rope-in kind of person. I mean, anybody who knows my history with churches knows I'm a little leery of all of that, and because I've been there, done that. And so, you know, I could have been much more diplomatic with him. I know now, if I'd have known then what I know now, I would have said something along the lines of exactly what you just said. I probably would have said, you know, Pastor, are you asking me, is Jesus my Savior? Yes, he is, absolutely. He saves me from everything that I can imagine. That you know, every pit or every trap I could fall into, Jesus saves me from that. He is absolutely my Savior. And that's what I would have said. And I suppose if he had kept pressing me, did he die for my sins, you know, I may have had to tell him, well, you know, I don't believe that Jesus was a ransom for sin. I'm sorry. I cannot believe that about my Heavenly Father. I refuse to believe that. And in fact, you know, the Urantia book says early on, I mean, it just doesn't mince words when it comes to the atonement doctrine. And so, you know, we can be diplomatic, but you know, what's the word it used? I'm going to find the quote here, Andre, and I think it's one of the few times in the book where it uses the word repugnant.
Oh, yes, it's in paper 4, I think. It's in the Erroneous Concepts of God section. It talks about how this doctrine of, you know, it's repulsive to the celestial beings. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, is it repugnant? It didn't come up with...
Oh, it says repulsive. It does say repulsive.
Repulsive? Okay.
Yeah.
I know it says puerile, too. Maybe
yeah,
Luke can find it for
yeah.
me. Anyway, it says to hold such a concept is puerile. It represents a primitive, a wholly primitive
yes.
notion. And it's repugnant and puerile. And... So, you know, I mean, if we're going to to go there, then I think we have to be truthful. And this is the idea. I mean, we got to get to the heart of why this is a concept. This concept alone holds people away from God.
But I think, you know what, though? I think it's interesting. It holds people away from God, yes, but it's also, unfortunately, the heart of the gospel for a lot of Christians. And I think that what I find for me, I will not give people the whole truth unless I really see that they're hungry and receptive. If someone is in resistance mode, then I'm only going to give them what they can assimilate, because otherwise it's like giving too much light to someone. It's going to blind them.
Well, you're right, and that is, you know, I at this point I probably wouldn't go there with him, especially not a pastor of an evangelical church. No,
right.
I wouldn't go there with him. I'd just say, you know, Pastor, I really don't want to talk about it, and I just wouldn't go there. I mean, you know, because you don't have to reveal everything. I think Jesus taught us that. You know, He didn't tell everybody everything. But I found that quote, Andre. Here it is. It's on page 60 of the original book. It's from part 1, paper 4, section section 5, and you're absolutely right. Erroneous ideas of God. You have a great memory. It says, the barbarous idea of appeasing an angry God, of propitiating an offended Lord, of winning the favor of deity through sacrifices and penance, and even by the shedding of blood, represents a religion wholly puerile and primitive, a philosophy unworthy of an enlightened age of science and truth. Such beliefs are utterly repulsive to the celestial beings and the divine rulers who serve and reign in the universes. It is an affront to God to believe, hold, or teach that innocent blood must be shed in order to win his favor or to divert the fictitious divine wrath.
Well, that's the sad thing. It's like you've said before so many times. I know we're kind of digressing here, but, you know, the problem with the atonement doctrine is it assumes that Jesus is here to save us from God. I mean, that's, you know, I actually read I should read this on the air sometime. There's a crazy piece I read. There's an evangelical pastor named John Piper who wrote a book called, an article called "Defending My Father's Wrath," you know, and he was saying the love of God saved me from the wrath of God, so I can become a son of God. You know, so it's just unbelievable. You know, it's like, you know, to think that God needs to save us from Himself. I mean, that's really what, you know, it's just, and that's why I think the Urantia book spends so much time attacking this concept, because it's such an assault on the unity of deity. You know, this makes God look like he's internally conflicted, like he can't make up his mind how he feels about his children. I mean, it's just, you know, I mean, I can understand why. I mean, it was hard for me to let go of it for a long time, but I think the reason they spent so much time talking about it is because it is so ingrained. You know, I think it's harder, I think I mentioned this on the air before, I think it's harder for people to let go of this than it is for them to accept, you know, the race teachings in the Urantia book.
Yeah, I agree. You're flying right in the face. I mean, obviously, for Catholics, it would be the idea that Mary is not the
Virgin. Yeah.
Yeah, and the concept of atonement for the rest of the Christian world is the biggest obstacle that any of us face, I think. You know, and excuse me, and you know, I talked to Meredith Sprunger about this, and I think I've said this on the air before. He told me, you know, Paula, most ministers already don't agree with the atonement doctrine anymore, but it's going to take a while for that to trickle down to the end.
Actually, but the interesting thing about that, that's true when it comes to the mainline liberal churches, but when it comes to the fundamentalist churches, the opposite's happening. I find the lay people are much more receptive to the Urantia book than the clergy. I mean, the clergy, they've got to keep their jobs. They're, you know, they're just... But let me, I want to give our phone number out again, 646-716-8151. 5-8, that's 646-716-8158. What resistance have you encountered in either sharing the Urantia book or when you've told people about the book, that you're a reader? I can tell you, for everybody to know, I found the book when I was 14. And a friend of mine introduced it to me. In fact, Bro Dave, his son, introduced it to me. And so that's why I've known Bro Dave for quite some time. And I used to go to study group at Bro Dave's house. Anyway, when I was 14, I found the book, and his dad had been, you know, Dave had been reading it for a long time, and so we'd go to study, but I at first it was just an intellectual thing for me. I think I've talked about this on the air. Well, first of all, my mother, when I told my family about it, my mom just thought I was crazy. You know, at first she's like, "What is this book?" You know, and she actually told me at one point, she goes, "You're gonna have to make a choice between the Urantia book and your family." You know, all this stuff, which, you know, that was all melodrama. It never, you know, that never happened. But you know, my biggest frustration was that, you know, I needed more than just intellectual experience. I wanted, you know, my born-again Christian friends would come to me and tell me, "Do you know that Jesus could change your life? Do you know that you can have this personal relationship with Jesus?" And the Urantia book talks about a personal relationship with God. And it does even, I think, even talk about a personal relationship with Jesus. But the thing is that at that time, back in the 80s, the groups I was going to were pretty intellectual. And nothing wrong with intellectual stuff, believe me, but there was no... there really wasn't any sense of group prayer or group worship. I didn't hear people talk about their personal experiences with God or any of those things. And so I ended up in a situation where I was going back and forth between the Urantia book and fundamentalist Christianity. And sometimes what I would do is I would go, and I still do this to a certain extent, although not as much, because the Urantia movement, thankfully, is changing a lot for the better. But at the time, I would have certain needs that I would get met at the Urantia meetings and study groups. I'd have my intellectual needs. And then when I wanted to worship and praise God, I'd go to church. You know, and you know, I really, so it kind of was a real sort of a, you know, kind of a back and forth for me in a lot of ways. But one thing, I think the thing that I used to never understand people who would say, and I'm not for secrecy about the book, no, but I am for prudence in who we share the book with. And, you know, I'm being quite public about the book by doing the Cosmic Citizen. Thankfully, my Christian friends don't see any reason to Google me. So they wouldn't find it. But I have, you know, I have a lot of friends I go to Bible study with, and I just kind of serve as leaven, you know, try to be leaven there, you know, and just kind of, you know, I don't tell them everything. I don't tell them all the things I believe. But I give them enough challenging information, again, that they can assimilate, that they can deal with. And, you know, this is consistent, Paula, I believe, with Jesus, because when Jesus was talking to Nathanael, you know, what does he say? He said, there's a section called the Talk with Nathanael in the Urantia book. I can't remember what paper it's in, but it's in the 1764, 1767, something like that in the original edition. But you know, Jesus says to Nathanael says to Jesus, he says, you know, I get the sense that you don't believe the Bible is the word of God like the rabbis do. You know, you don't believe that the words of Abraham have been the words of the law were in heaven with Abraham, you know, forever. And Jesus says, no, you're right. He says, you're right. He goes, I don't view the scriptures the way the rabbis do. And he says, but I'll share this teaching with you only on condition that you don't repeat it to your brethren who are not prepared to receive this teaching. So even Jesus understood the wisdom of not sharing everything with everyone. And I think that that's when, you know, that when we become charming evangels or truth, you know, truth givers or whatever you want to call it, you know, that's what we do. We use discernment, we use prudence as to what we share with who. And I think that's where real wisdom comes in. You know, that's why Jesus says, you know, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. So I do understand now the wisdom of that. Because, again, you don't want to encounter resistance. You want to give people what their hearts are ready for.
Well, I absolutely agree, Andre. And, you know, I think we all have to learn this the hard way with the Urantia book. You know, I mean, I have friends, honestly, dear, dear friends, that I've never told I read it because I'm afraid that it would ruin that relationship.
Mm.
And they're people that are important to me. I love them. They're important to my family. One is the person who provided daycare to my precious daughter for probably 6 years. And they're salt of the earth kind of people. They don't really even go to church every Sunday, but they're definitely, that's their background. And they, you know, I think that the wife would understand, I'm almost certain the husband wouldn't. And, you know, I don't want to ruin that relationship. So I've never sent anything. And, you know, it's never really, they know I work for a religious nonprofit. You know, they know I'm the director of a religious nonprofit. And they know I love Jesus. Oh, man, you know, I'll talk about Jesus to anybody. I went to the South with my husband, Glenn, and this was, you know, that first experience in 83 really taught me a valuable lesson. If I'm with Christians, what I've learned is I can talk about Jesus with them all day long, and we will get along splendidly. And I don't have to mention the Bible or anything. They just make assumptions. But when we're talking about our love of Jesus, we're on the same page. And I went to the South to meet my husband's family, to Mississippi. And, they all loved me so much. They just thought, wow, what a wonderful Jesus person. What a wonderful sister in Christ. And we didn't talk theology at all. I just kept it on a level of, oh, yes, I love Jesus. And I would quote Jesus, and they'd all look at me like, wow, that's so cool. That's so fantastic. They just loved it. And you know, so the pastor in the canyon really taught me that, you know, there's things you can say and things you can't say. And of course, Jesus, obviously. I mean, what do? He went and traveled all throughout the Mediterranean with Garnet and Gannet and never told anybody in his family that's what he did.
Exactly. That's a very good point. That's a very good point. And I think we need to be very gracious with those who feel that they can't discuss, you know, their involvement. I mean, we've had people on the air. We've had a good friend of mine who's a professor on the air who just, you know, who basically, you know, he didn't want to reveal his name. We called him the good doctor. And, you know, there are people who have been on the show anonymously, and I think we need to respect that. And I think that you know, there's a lot of, again, there's a lot of stuff that people can, a lot of opposition people can run into. So, again, do we have any callers yet, Paula?
No, I'm begging on the board.
We want to hear from you, folks. We want to hear your story. We want all the dirt. No, I'm just kidding. This is Jerry Springer. Jerry Springer on the Cosmic Citizen. No, I'm just kidding. We want to hear your stories. We want to hear your struggles. We want to hear if you've encountered any resistance from people.
Yeah, you know, and Andre, I've heard lots of stories from lots of people over the years of the challenges they've faced. And you know, and they stay with you, they stay with me because of the lessons learned, you know, and the people who have lost family members, who have been written out of wills, have been written out of their father's will because they read the Urantia book. Such a bitter, bitter disappointment.
Now, was that in a fundamentalist Christian family?
No, Jewish.
Oh, wow. Well, that probably would have happened if the person had said they were a Christian and believed the Bible, too. In a Jewish family like that, the person probably would have been written out of their father's will if they said that they were a born-again Christian and believed the Bible, too. I mean, in that particular case.
This person's mother was a Christian. And
oh, really?
Father, yeah. And they had a great, strong, wonderful marriage, but the mother died early. But that always left a hunger in this person's heart to find out who his mother was and what his mother believed. And so, you know, but I think that his father never dreamed, and it wasn't so much, you're right, though, it wasn't so much the UB as it was this Jesus thing.
But what I don't understand is why the father could accept it in his mother, but not in his son.
Well, I think that the Urantia book brings out a love for Jesus that's not common.
Wow.
You know, I mean, Jesus becomes the hero of all heroes. I mean, I know Christians feel this way about him, too. But the fervor, you know, for somebody who's Jewish to love Jesus that much as this person does, is really quite stark in a Jewish family that now doesn't have the Christian mother in it to say, hey, wait, it's okay if he loves Jesus, you know. So, yeah, it was just too much. And so, hey, we have a caller.
Good, good.
Let's see who we got here. 714, you're on the Cosmic Citizen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
This is Mark.
Hey, Mark.
Hey, Mark Erickson, how are you? I'm sorry, you don't
Hello,
shoot.
Guys.
I don't know if I'm supposed to give your last name out on the air. I'm sorry.
I have my last name right on the chat board, so it's no
problem. Okay, okay, okay. Good.
You guys are doing another wonderful job this morning.
Thank you, Mark.
And speaking of Jewish, here I am.
even with a name like Erickson, isn't that like a good Norwegian name?
I know the rabbi had a big problem with it, too.
Hey, Mark, isn't Erickson like a good Norwegian name? I didn't think it doesn't sound very Jewish to me.
Yeah, I know. I know. And my father never converted, and the rabbi wouldn't bar mitzvah me. Can you believe it?
Oh, wow.
Wow. Why?
So I had to go to another rabbi, and it was the best thing that ever happened to me because he absolutely inspired me. And that was the beginning of my spiritual quest.
Wow.
So, Mark, tell us your story. Was your father a Christian?
Yes, always was.
Wow.
And my mother was Jewish.
Wow, okay.
But as it turned, you know, but everybody's a little bit of everything. We used to have Christmas in the living room and Hanukkah in the family room, and that's just the way it was, you know, my whole entire life. And my mother ended up being Mrs. Claus for Ronald McDonald House.
Wow.
Anyway.
Mrs. Claus.
It was just that kind of life. As far as my challenges with regard to the Urantia book, my biggest challenge was myself. Because of my Jewish upbringing, because of my basic nature of being pretty skeptical, particularly with regard to the origins of the book, it took me, for about the first 2 years, while I was reading the book, I was also researching the origins of the book. It was an amazing sort of a transition from going from being skeptical about the book to just having absolutely no doubt whatsoever that what I was reading was exactly what it portended to be, without, like, just all on my own. But
right.
That was my biggest challenge.
Now, Mark, I know a little bit about your story, and I know that you found the book years ago, and you put it down for a while, and then you picked it up again. Is that true?
Yes. My sister is the one that originally gave me the book about 30 years ago without really knowing anything about it.
Wow.
Why did she give it to you, Mark?
Well, she found it. She was waiting someplace and for somebody in some place like a club where they have just happen to have books on a shelf. She went for the widest book on the shelf. She flipped through the pages and decided almost immediately that it would be a book that her brother might be interested in,
okay.
Wrote down the
okay.
title, found one, bought it for me without really even knowing anything about it. That was 30 years ago.
She gave it to you, and you initially started reading it?
Exactly. I initially started reading it. I was very interested in it. I loved it. And at the time, I tried to interest my wife in the book. And anybody who knew anything about us knew how intertwined our two lives were, both personally, socially, professionally. There was no way that I was going to be, because I don't do anything halfway.
Right.
There was just no way that I was going to get involved in this Urantia community without my wife also being interested. So I said earlier in the board that I was actually in St. Hyacinth about 17 years ago when you were all there, and Anne was with me at the time. And we spent a couple of days there at that international meeting. And we loved it. We loved meeting the people. We had a great time. But my wife was just not interested.
Wow.
So
Is your wife Jewish?
I put the book on the shelf. What?
Is your wife Jewish, too?
No.
No, okay.
No. Now, I was raised Jewish, but when we married, we kind of landed on the Church of Religious Science together.
Oh.
But
well,
my wife passed away a little over 2 years ago, and I took the book off the shelf, and then I jumped in with both feet, and I haven't stopped, as you obviously know.
So you didn't read the entire thing until she passed away, or did you read it before?
I have to be quite honest with you and everyone that I really have not read the entire book from start to finish yet. There are parts of the book that I just don't even choose to take on by myself.
Right, I understand that.
And you're a great study group right now, though, aren't you?
Yes, I go to the study group at Robert Burns' home in Irvine, and Cindy's house.
Perfect.
The other big challenge.
You're right. This is such an important point, Mark. I read the book by myself. I found it when I was 20 years old. I read it for 2 years by myself. I got, three quarters of the way through. Well, I got up to, almost the end of part three before I wrote the Urantia Foundation, and I said, oh, please, I can't be the only person in the world reading this book. I have to talk to somebody else about it. I have to. And she sent me back two contact names, and I contacted those people immediately. They were in my area. Started going to study group in 1977, and I've been going, almost weekly since then. And it is so helpful to read this thing with other people because, my heart goes out to people like you, Kev, in Tokyo, It's hard to read this thing by yourself, and that's why I'm glad we're here on Saturday mornings for Kevin and anybody who doesn't have a study group. They can call and connect with a community that knows this thing and loves it and believes it so that they can get some feedback on it because it's vitally important.
And let me piggyback
Paula.
And let me piggyback on something, too, that Mark said because – Paul, this is really important to me. Mark, I want you to know, not that I'm a person of authority or anything, but I want you to just know as a fellow reader, it's okay that you haven't read the whole book yet. You're still one of us. You're a believer. Let me tell you why I think it's so important to bring that up, because I know people who are very fanatical about this. They're like, you've got to read the whole book front to back. That's the only way to do it. That's the way the Revelators did it. Well, maybe ideally that's true. Maybe ideally that's the right way to read it. But you know what? Since when does any of us do anything ideally in this life? And I think we need to extend a lot.
Andre, let me confide in you that I have decided, quite a while ago, that I will probably never, ever be a scholar of this book. And that's perfectly all right.
Exactly. Exactly, because you're doing such a good job in what you're doing to promote it, and that's perfectly fine. But the other thing, though, because I hear people say things like, the book, the Revelators revealed things from the complex to the simple and not from the simple to the complex, and so you should start at the beginning. I mean, folks, let's not turn the Urantia movement into a religion of authority, where people need to read at their own pace, where they want to read, when they want to read. If someone only wants to read the Jesus Papers, great. That's enough. That's more truth than most people on this planet have. And so I think we need to really extend a lot of grace to our fellow readers and people who are interested in the book.
Well, and also, Mark, I want to say, gosh, I envy you because you have that in front of you if you want to do it. And it's so enthralling. It doesn't matter to me how people read it, and I've met more people than not that started somewhere else in the book. They were interested in Adam and Eve. They started there. They were interested in Jesus. They started there. And then decided, maybe I'll read this thing from cover to cover. Nobody ever regrets reading it from cover to cover. There are times when it's a slog, though. I've read it from cover to cover with a group, and I think it took us like 7 years. And it It was great. I really appreciated doing that because, you know, there's people in group always, like Chris Halverson, who help you get through, who helped me get through the scientific parts. I'm more of a philosophical, spiritual thinker, and so I really enjoy the philosophy of the Urantia book and the spirituality, you know, the spiritual teachings of the book. But the science sometimes just really, you know, bogs me down, like papers like Energy, Mind, and Matter.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with you there. That's hard for me.
You know, you're like, well, yeah, you know, well, so what? And Chris Halverson then will say, but you know, do you realize the implications of this? You know, and he'll launch on all of that, and you're enthralled. And so, you know, I guess, bravo for study group, and bravo for being in Robert's group, Mark, and I'm so glad you decided to come and hang with us. You are a remarkable person and a loving service.
I want to, if I may, while I'm here, I just want to also share the second challenge that I had with the book because of my Jewish upbringing, because it's kind of a special personal thing that I had to go through with the book, and I do like to share it, and that was because of my upbringing, and because of the special way that I approached the book. I went right to part three. I went right to part three to begin with because it parallels the Old Testament, which was my Jewish upbringing. So I could relate to the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve, Moses, the beginning of monotheism, et cetera, et cetera, and that was where I was comfortable getting started with the book. If I had started the book in the beginning, I don't, quite honestly, don't know how far I would have gotten, to be quite honest with you. But then I got through part three, and then I was faced with the next challenge, and that was part four. And I had to take a deep breath. I had to gulp very strong, long, and hard, and say, am I ready to meet the master? And forward, because I'd never had a relationship with Jesus because of my upbringing. So I flowed right into part four, and it was just the most wonderful awakening that I think I have ever had in my life.
Mm.
Just a remarkable experience. And and now, of course, I have a personal relationship with Jesus, and totally, and I think I really understand probably better than most Christians about what he was all about, what he came here for, and what he means.
Well, let me ask you this: I think it's wonderful, by the way, to hear you say that. It's just so, I mean, did you ever think you ever would say that as a Jew, that you have a personal relationship with Jesus? You know, but I think that's wonderful. But let me ask you this, and maybe I'm stepping on some thin ice here my understanding. Okay, there are a lot of people, non-Christians, who will say, well, you know, Jesus is a good man, he's a prophet, but he's not really God. Okay, now, even though the Urantia book doesn't say that he's the second person of the Trinity, it does say that he's God. How did that, you know, that his, you know, that he is deity, represents all the attributes of the universal Father and the eternal Son, how did that, was that hard for you to accept his divinity?
You have to understand that my Jewish upbringing, and I think this also holds for most Christian educations also, that they don't approach any of this kind of stuff really to any extent whatsoever. So all of this stuff is all brand new territory when you start really getting into the teachings of the Urantia book. Don't you agree?
Yeah, I suppose that's true in a lot of ways. I guess I don't look at it that way because to me it kind of builds on so many things that I was also a truth seeker. I mean, I was reading the Bible, I was doing all this, you know. So I mean, you know, but I guess what you're saying is that in the average Jewish education system, you're saying that you just don't talk about these things. So it was all brand new to you. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yes, it's all brand new to me.
That's probably true to a lot of people. Unless they're, you know, it's depending on how they grew up. If they grew up nominally Christian or nominally Jewish, then you're probably right. I don't know, you know, the extent of what your, you know, what your, how nominal your affiliation was when you grew up, but that's probably true.
The only other one thing that I would say about my Jewish upbringing that I have found, and I'm kind of disappointed with, to be quite honest with you, is the fact that in spite of the fact that Jesus lived a life on this planet, I find it hard to accept that the Jewish faith in general doesn't at least accept his teachings with a little more respect. They really don't even recognize it or even bring it up. And it's kind of disappointing to me, but because it's such a beautiful teaching, you know, that I think that they're really missing out in that regard. Whereas Islam does accept Jesus as one of their prophets, even though they don't really get too heavily into it either. But I just don't understand that about Judaism, to tell you the truth.
What is it you don't understand about him, Mark? I'm sorry, I missed
that. Okay. Jesus lived a Jewish life, and he was a great rabbi.
Mm.
And why the Jewish faith today doesn't at least accept him for what he was and for the great teacher that he was, and at least acknowledge his existence to a greater extent, I just don't understand.
Well, he wasn't actually a rabbi in the sense that he was a clergyman, but he was a rabbi in the sense that he was a teacher, yes.
So that's what a rabbi is.
And clearly, his followers were Jewish, and they took his teachings to the entire world. You know, that's something that I've pondered quite a bit, Mark, is, you know, it had its birth in Judaism, and we even call our faith Judeo-Christian. We accept the scriptures, which are, you know, Jewish scriptures, essentially, and we call Jesus the New Testament. And, you know, so I have pondered that, you know, I have to think that a lot of this is just based on the terrible persecutions they faced in Jesus' name. And it's not about Jesus, really. You know, what do you think about that, Mark?
I don't know. I remember growing up, you know, because I was a product of a mixed marriage, and I would be in the, and as a kid, when the family would get together for holidays, and after imbibing a little on both sides of the family, I remember hearing these conversations and actually arguments about, like, who actually crucified Jesus. And I just thought, oh, you know, I don't know. It's just been a sensitivity in my life. So,
well,
can I
maybe raise a few questions here? In some ways, it's understandable, I think, why so many Jews have don't want to give Jesus don't want to acknowledge his part as a great teacher. And I think one of the biggest reasons is because Jesus was so at odds with the Jewish religious leaders. He wasn't at odds with all the Jews, but he was at odds with the religious leaders. I mean, I know it's politically incorrect to say this, but, you know, the Jewish religious leaders were the ones that wanted Jesus dead, not the Romans. You know, Pilate had to be persuaded to put Jesus to death. I mean, he was a gutless coward. He was a status quo politician, but he really didn't want, you know, it was the religious folks in Jerusalem who wanted him executed. And I think, you know, I mean, Jesus has a parable about the wicked vine growers, you know, in the garden, the ones who killed the prophets and killed, you know. And so I think I can see why some Jews might interpret that as anti-Semitic, though the interesting thing is that his disciples were all Jews too, and so were, you know, most of his followers, initially at least. So, you know, I can understand to some extent why. There's actually an interesting book by a guy named Jacob Neusner, who's a rabbi. It's called A Rabbi Talks with Jesus. And I haven't read it, but I read little excerpts from it. And it was very interesting because, you know, he rejects Jesus, but the things he says about Jesus are true. Like, for example, he says he doesn't like the fact that Jesus tells people to that they might have to give up their families, you know. But the thing is, Jesus did say those things, and he actually is more honest about what Jesus said than a lot of Christians are.
Mm-hmm.
Well, listen, you guys, we have another caller. Mark, you want to hang on here with us?
Oh, sure, okay.
Okay, cool. Caller, you're on Blog Talk, the Cosmic Citizen.
Hello, am I the caller?
Yeah, you are.
Oh, okay. Well, this is Justin. I'm calling from Japan, so I'm trying to keep my voice a little low. It's kind of late here. But I did. Can you hear me clearly?
Yeah, where are you calling? Wait, are you from New York?
Oh, yeah, Justin from New York. Now,
yeah, I remember meeting you at the LA conference a couple years back.
Right. And of course.
And you are in Japan right now?
Yes. I moved to Japan last March, and I've been living here, I guess, for like the last 10 months or so.
Where do you live in Japan?
I live in not too far from Kevin, actually. Kevin.
Hey.
I live in Sagamihara, so it's pretty close to where Kevin actually lives. I think we've talked we've chatted a few times, and so there are at least two Urantia book readers in Japan. And in roughly the same area, even, so it's pretty auspicious. I guess what I wanted to call in about was, I guess the last caller, Eric, was it? Are you still there? I'm not sure. Mark Erickson really inspired me with.
I tell you what, I'm going to leave the line and go back to the chat room, okay? Because I have trouble with my cell phone. Okay,
oh,
bye.
Sure.
That's fine.
Hey, Mark, thank you for calling.
Bye.
That telling really inspired me because there was, I kind of had a different experience when it came to trying to introduce the revelation. And for me, the problem was, my biggest problem with the Urantia book is that it's a book. It's like the fact that it's a book, that it's in writing, puts it in direct competition with everyone's doctrine. And it becomes a question of doctrine, comparative doctrine. And it becomes a scholarly thing where they start trying to compare facts. And, here it says that Jesus said that, but in this one it says that Jesus said that. And it becomes a purely scholarly affair. So even the people who are really, really devout, in their religious faith, those are the ones that still try to intellectualize the whole thing and try to somehow reason out the truth of it based on the fact that it's a book and should therefore be looked at the way that all textbooks are looked at, or like the way that even the Bible is looked at. It's almost as if
Justin, you're basically saying, it sounds to me like you're saying, if people will say, well, what makes this book different from that book? Or it's like a competition between, books that claim sacred status or divine status.
Well, that would be the other side of it, actually. I think, a lot of Christians have become comfortable with the fact that there are Muslims that think that their book is sacred, and that there are Jews that think that they have the original and the last word on it so far. But I think that the people of the book, so to speak, have become comfortable with that. But the way they're dealing with that has been to just intellectualize it, to take it apart in a scholarly way, instead of trying to really digest it and really discern the truth in it and the spirit of it. So it becomes a question of comparing facts. And that's for the people who are really firmly entrenched in their faith. And on the other side of it, there are the people like you're saying who just say, well, they're all books, and they're either all true or none of them are true. And so they're kind of a non-committal about it. But I think the biggest problem is really, either way, is the fact that it's a book, and therefore it puts it into the realm of the human intellect instead of the human experience.
Wow. Well, I've heard Urantia book readers say this before in other ways, and ponder, actually, how can we, and Andre, I think you mentioned this early on in the show, that you would go back to the church to experience worship with with fellow believers, because when you were in study group or whatever, it was so intellectual.
And I don't want to make it sound like I really want to clarify this, because I don't want to make it sound like the intellectual thing is bad. One of the things that I've been talking to some people on the internet about is, faith. I think some people think, well, faith is just a matter of personal experience. Well, that's part of it, but that's not all of it. I mean, one of the things people that attracts people to the Your Answer book is how logical it is, and look at how consistent it is, and how it uses facts and evidence, and it doesn't just expect people to believe something that is irrational or illogical. So I don't want to make it sound like you know, faith and reason are in conflict, or the intellectual stuff isn't important. It's just that, you know, I believe that we are, you know, we have hearts as well as minds, and I think that, you know, that's what I felt like, at least back in the 80s when I was going to study group, I felt like it was all intellectual. There was no, you know, and thankfully I've been seeing a lot of changes recently in study groups. I'm seeing people being willing to pray. I'm seeing people being willing to, it's become much more, people become much more open to, I think, experiencing different facets of the revelation rather than just only the intellectual part.
Well, you know, I here now in Japan, and I've only had a few months or just about a worth of time experiencing the culture here. But I mean, when we talk about the problem between Christians and Jews and Muslims, we really haven't even, that's the tip of the iceberg. When you go to the other side of the world, you can really see what it's like when there is a complete convolution of faiths, and it's completely, in fact, it's almost like spiritually dark in a way. I don't want to insult anyone, but in a way. And one of the problems that, you know, I guess the main problem that I see is that, you know, here in the East, I can see that people really need to have a personal experience, and they just experience something that's so foreign from their culture. So they have their ancestors, and they have their whatever idols it is that their particular family was partial to, and the shrines, and all of these things are familiar to them, just as a matter of ritual, just as a matter of as routine. And that's really nice for them. I guess the problem with things like the Atlantic book is that where does the perceptive wisdom fit into that routine? You know, where does Machavinta Melchizedek fit into that routine? How do you even pronounce that? Does everyone pronounce it the same? I mean, where does a primary or secondary Renanandek, where does that fit into the, you know, the routine? How do you work that into your religious faith? How do you make that, you know, something you can live? And there's just very few people, I think, actually, who are able to do that, to just read it in a book and say, okay, now this is a part of my faith. I think that it is a lot more like what Mark was just saying, where you're just going to have to disregard certain things because it's just not relevant.
Well, and you know,
and so,
what I always found as I was reading some of those things, was I would ask myself, you know, on the surface, this doesn't seem to be relevant to me. Why are they telling me this? You know, why do I need to know about Cronal Dex and Lenanan Dex? And, you know, how is that relevant to me? And I would find deeper meanings every time I asked that question. You know, because sometimes it seems like, wow, you know, but they're telling you, but what are they telling you? You know, there's a lot of information in this idea of descending orders, and mm-hmm. how they fit into our ascendant scheme, and you know, it all plays into our greater understanding of our situation where we find ourselves now in the middle of a rebellion on an isolated planet,
right.
And also. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example of what you were describing. I have a friend in Boston who pointed out to me one time, you know, Paula, when I want to meditate, I go on a journey to the Seven Fathers. And I said, Daniel, what do you mean? He said, well, he said, the Urantia book teaches that we have seven fathers and that we will meet and come to know seven fathers in our ascension, the first being the biological father, the second being the father of the realm, the third being the system father, the fourth being the universe father, the fifth being the most highs, the sixth being the, not the most highs, but my mind is blank now, and that the seventh is the father on paradise.
Huh? Yeah, which one would you, I'm sorry, I missed what you were, where you were at with that. The fifth one?
Yeah, the Ancients of Days. The sixth is the Ancients of Days, and the seventh is the Universal Father. And he said, when I want to get to the Father, I start by saying, thank you to my biological father. I go deep in my heart and I say, thank you, Father. Thank you for all of the good things you tried to give me, you know, on this world, the lessons you tried to teach me of love and or whatever you felt like. I know, you know, you made your mistakes, but you did the best you could. Thank you, Father Adam, for what you tried to do for us, you know. And he said, I go up in my mind. I thank each one. I thank the system, Father, Lana Forge, right now. Thank you, Lana Forge, you know. Beautiful Lenon and Duck son, thank you for your service to this system of worlds. Thank you for all that you've done for us, your service and your love and your ministry. Thank you, Father Lenon and Duck. And he's, I go to Jesus. I say, thank you, Jesus. Thank you, Lord, for your wonderful ministry to this universe and your beautiful and you know, competent guidance and all of the wonderful ways that you serve us. Thank you, Lord Jesus. Thank you, Master Michael of Nebadon. And then I go up further to, you know, the Most Highs of Norlashadek and so on and so forth, and all the way to the Father on Paradise. Where,
you know, that,
by the time I get to the Father, I am in absolute worship. I'm in total worship, and all I do in my mind is I go through those seven Fathers. So that's just an example of how somebody can take those teachings, which might not seem to be very relevant, and really internalize them and have a wonderful spiritual experience with them.
And see, that's what I'm saying. It's that example that's lacking. When you put it in a book, there's no such example. So now you give someone a book and say, I think you should read this. But they have no template for which to really enact this, to have this be a part of their life or to be relevant to their life. I guess what I'm saying is the biggest problem, it's not so much that it's, you know, that the Lantern book is just, it can't be understood by people, but it's just that there's so many Rantia book readers right now. All of us are trying to get people to read the book, but to demonstrate how it actually applies to our lives in those details that most people would never even think they need to know.
Right. Okay, I get you. And so it's up to us. It's our job, if we know it and love it, just like Daniel did for me, to point out some things you can do.
I'm having a really hard time telling my father about, you know, the Ancients of Days. in the context of our conversation, every once in a while, and this is just in my brief moments of inspiration, I may be able to actually have a recognition of their presence. When I say presence, I'm saying my understanding, my comprehension, my discernment of their influence. And then I might acknowledge them then in the moment, and he might understand that what's happening in that situation the Ancients of Days, that makes some sense. That's why you would know about them, because that in that context, then that's where it's relevant. But then to just give them a book and say, okay, you thought that you were struggling.
I'm sorry, what?
Sort of like saying, you know, even though you were struggling with Christianity because you wanted to know Jesus more and you couldn't memorize the Bible and you couldn't quote everything and you couldn't stop beating your children to boot. But now here's this other book that's got even more details that you didn't even know you needed. You know,
right.
So I think there's a lot of resistance against that. And for me personally, the only way to get around it has been to just to be speaking of it as a matter of fact, not as a matter of, well, as a matter of experience, not as a matter of fact, you know, and from the book. You know, saying the Urantia book says this, the Urantia book says that, the Urantia book says that.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, rather than quoting the book. Yeah, I think the thing that's really going to attract people, the thing that's really going to attract people to the revelation, you know, and the book says this, is to see Jesus living again in the lives of spirit-born mortals. So, you know, we need to recognize that, and we need to make sure, you know, do we have God in our hearts? I mean, we all have God in our hearts in the fact that we have thought of justice, but I mean, the question I'm making, saying is, are we, you know, oh, what's going on? I'm hearing my.
There's a bit of an echo, Andre.
Yeah, I don't know where that's coming from. It's okay, it's gone now. But anyway, you know, where are we in terms of, I've been before on the air, but the Urantia book is not a substitute for a relationship with God. But the interesting thing, though, is as I became as I became closer and closer to the Father, and I began to spend more time in prayer with God, I became more and more convinced of the truth of the Urantia book, because I knew that God couldn't be this wrathful, angry God that the church was, you know, telling me he was, you know. And so that's what brought me back to the Urantia book after taking a break from it for 10 years, actually. So that was really, you know.
Well, and your point is so well taken, and I think we really do need to express it in terms of experience. And, you know, I try to do that when I'm talking to people about it. I try to give them an example of what it's meant for me, what it means to me, the doors that it's opened for me in my heart, in my life, the things that it's done for me, you know. And I find that that's a much more effective way to share it with somebody than to get into this realm of words they've never heard or terminology they're unfamiliar with. And for me also, there are many people I meet who don't care at all about other planets and celestial beings and the hierarchy of things and the grand and glorious ministry of the Heavenly Father and all of his ascending and descending children and everything that's going on in the universe. They don't give a fig, but they love Jesus, and they would love the teachings of Jesus. And you know, I can tell them, look, you know, because I have met so many people at doing my work in public outreach with the Urantia book, and the conversation is always the same. They say, you know, I tried to read that book. It's just too deep for me. And we all know that experience, because sometimes it just gives you a headache. And you start, you know, you can imagine this poor soul. I always imagine this soul picking up this book and starting with the foreword and getting maybe two pages in and thinking, my gosh, I'll never be able to understand this book. And I will always tell them, you know, I know it's deep, but, you know, if you jump to the back and read part four, The Life and Teachings of Jesus, start there. Did you read that part? And they always look at me blankly and say, is that in there? They don't even know it's in there. And, you know, I have met so many people who tried to read the front parts of the book, couldn't, and then as a result went back and read the Jesus part. And to me, if that's all they ever do, is just part four, to know the Creator Son, to know Jesus in that way, is literally the most important thing that's ever happened to me. To have those
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Justin.
You know, I was thinking as you said that, because I actually attend a church here in Japan. I was able to find a bilingual church. And, of course, they're struggling with the fact that I'm a Urantia book reader. They are just literally have just been converted from their Shinto Buddhist families. And, you know, it's like a lot to swallow considering, you know, they defied their family just to become Christian, you know, and they're just trying to learn that. So, of course, I'm not trying to, you know, teach them facts or anything like that, but they're just really, they feel that just the fact that I'm coming here and I read this book and they have this forward thinking, and they don't know what to make of it. So they're trying to put it all together again now. But as you were saying that, I guess what occurred to me is that even Christians who have a very good and firm and emotional relationship, a heartfelt relationship where it counts, a heartfelt relationship with Jesus, They don't know about the afterlife. They don't know about the fact that no one's going to hell. You have to want to survive. You don't have to just want to not go to hell. You have to want to ascend. They don't know about that.
Huh.
You know, so it's sort of like, you know, no matter where you go, even if you go to people who've had a personal relationship, then there's still all these other details. You know, that they don't know. They don't even know that they need to know, and a lot of them don't want to feel like they need to know that.
Well, you know, for me,
does that make sense?
What led me to the Urantia book was a need to know where my father was.
Right.
And specifically that he was. And I've loved Jesus all my life, and I've read the Bible quite a bit. But I could not find those specifics that I was longing for. I didn't. It wasn't enough to know, for me anyway, to know that Jesus, that my dad went to be with Jesus. I wanted very specific information. And that's what I prayed for. And certainly that's what I got.
Well, that's what I think those are your anti-book readers. Yeah. Look, I'm sorry. What are you saying?
I think
You know what? You guys finish your conversation. I'm going to close off and, you know, just stick with the chat board so you guys can continue on.
Colin,
all right.
God bless you, man.
Thank you, John.
God bless you too. Bye now.
Yeah, I think I can understand, Paula, why you wanted to know where your dad was, because I think one of the things that we have in the Urantia book, and we talked about this, you know, on the air before, is, you know, this incredibly comprehensive outline of what happens after death. I mean, that's just amazing. You know, we have something that so many people, you know, just don't. I mean, a lot of people have kind of a vague concept of what happens after death. They're not really sure. And, you know, we have so many specifics, you know. That alone, I think, you know, is worth a revelation, you know.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, I have literally been able to send that magazine, Life After Death. The Life After Death magazine was created by the Jesusonian Foundation back in 1987, and it capsulizes the teachings of the Urantia book about life after death, the whole ascension. And I've had parents who have lost children, did not ever read the Urantia book. But somebody gave them that magazine, and I've had them call me up and say, "Oh my gosh, I don't know how I would have gotten through this without this magazine. This thing gave me so much comfort to know that my child is okay and that I will see my child again." And, you know, that magazine was created back in the day when you couldn't quote more than like 300 words from the Urantia book. And, of course, Jesusonian wasn't given permission to quote any more than that. And so they really had to make do with just 300 direct, the quote of 300 words directly from the book. But Meredith Sprunger and Mo Siegel wrote that magazine, and Mo commissioned art. Our good friend Lenny Coles laid out the universe maps for Mo. Mo took that to John Byron, commissioned the universe art, and it was all for that magazine, so that he could use visuals and narrative to create a journey through the cosmos for the reader. And it's just a simple little thing, but it really makes a big difference. And of course, his thrust back then was outreach. How do we, you know, talk about the obstacles we face as people who want to turn somebody onto the teachings of the book? One of the obstacles we face is here we have this tome that's 2,000 pages, and we want to tell them about life after death because that's what they need. A parent who's lost a child needs to hear about that, right? But all we have is this tome. And, you know, you give it, you drop this gigantic thing on them and say, "Here, what you need is in here. Just read this whole book." But that's an obstacle.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Mo wanted to create outreach tools that would help us all share teachings from the book without, you know, having to drop a book on somebody. And, boy, that's a great one right there, Life After Death magazine. And it's at Truthbook site. You can page through the whole thing right there at truthbook.com if you want to send somebody there. And if you know somebody that's grieving and they want a magazine, please let me know. Just write to me, and I'll send you one to give them. That's what they're for. And Mo originally hoped to do, you know, one on angels, a magazine on angels, and That would have been fabulous. You know, I mean, I saw he spent a great deal of money and time creating the magazine he did create. And, you know, someday, you know, we'll all get behind projects like that. And we'll probably do some more really great projects like the Life After Death magazine. Anyway, we have another caller, Andre.
Good. I was going to ask you that. Maybe, how are we doing on time, Paula?
We have 20 minutes.
Okay, great.
Yeah. Oops. The caller just dropped off.
Okay. If you want to call back in, please do. And, again, we're interested in your stories about what resistance you've encountered, what obstacles you've encountered, what challenges you've encountered, either sharing the Arantia book with others or, you know, just letting people know that you read it. You know, is there anybody here who wants to call it anonymously? Maybe there are people who are in the closet and need to be in the closet. Maybe they don't want to reveal their names or, you know, or their full names. Maybe there are issues that they have to deal with professionally or personally, and they don't want their name to be revealed in terms of, so that people know that they're readers. Colin, give us a shout here. 646-716-8158. That's 646-716-8158. Our caller hasn't come back, have they?
No, not yet.
Okay.
Maybe just lost, you know, maybe the system dropped them out or something.
Oh, okay.
Or maybe they, I don't know. You know, it looked like somebody who had something to say, but then the call just went away real quickly. So.
Yeah.
You know, Andre, what you had mentioned earlier about, you know, that you perceive that there's, and I think Justin was kind of getting at this too, that there's some resistance to experiential, you know, group experience as religionists together. If we read the Arantia book, you know, a lot of people, and I can think of several dear friends who are very uncomfortable with group prayer.
Right,
group
right.
Worship.
There are some people like that, yeah.
Why do you suppose that is so prevalent? In our-
oh, boy. That's it. Well, first let me say that I used to be a lot more judgmental of people like that than I am now. And I think I'm not now because I think, unfortunately, and, you know, I wish this wasn't true, but I think a lot of people have been hurt by the church. And so to them, it's like a flashback. It's like being reminded of all the, you know, of all the bad things they experienced at church. And I think, for some, you know, they associate those things with other negative experiences they've had, like guilt and shame or some kind of spiritual abuse or whatever it might be. So I think that that's probably what's really at the root of it. Or there are people, or, you know, prayer is something, you know, prayer is a very vulnerable thing. It's about, you know, you're opening your most intimate self up to people. And I think I mean, I hate to be a psychoanalyst, but I think there's probably a lot of pain at the root of it. There's probably, you know, there may be people who are very wounded who haven't dealt with their wounds. And they don't want to share that side of themselves. It's hard for them to be vulnerable with their feelings. So that's kind of my take on it.
I had an experience talking about how people have been hurt by the church, and certainly, you know, we're talking about obstacles to our outreach. Here's a big one. Here's a big one right here. You know, people who have been persecuted in Jesus' name, they don't want to hear about Jesus. You know, people who have been told they're going to hell.
Sure.
Well, people who have been kicked out or shamed or, you know, whatever, that presents a huge obstacle to us. And I think that, you know, a lot of our brothers and sisters who read the Urantia book found comfort in the fact that they didn't need a middleman.
Right.
And they could have a personal relationship with their spiritual father. Without somebody intervening on their behalf, and they take that very personally, and they're comfortable with that, and it's safe to share on an intellectual level. You're right. I think you're absolutely right, Andre. It's, you know, it's safe to share at that level, but, you know, if you're going to get deeper into the heart level and share that as a group, that can be uncomfortable for people.
Yeah.
And especially those people who, you know, if church was uncomfortable for them, that could be uncomfortable for them too, you know. And I have found an obstacle with people who have been burned by churches, and they've turned to agnosticism or atheism. They've given up, and you know it's hard. I don't think you can easily cloak the religious language of the Urantia book. And of course, you know, I've had feminists talk to me about the paternal language of the book. You know, that's an obstacle.
Well, and I think you know, again, the flip side of that is, even though I'm more tolerant of people who don't want to pray in groups, the flip side of that, though, is that, you know, sometimes the resistance is so strong that it gets into a real intolerance of those of us who do want to pray in groups. I've heard some of your answer book readers, you know, imply that prayer should always be private, that it should never be done in groups, that it should never be done with another person. And when I talk about those things, you know, I get there's a lot of judgment that comes through. A lot of times, you know, they'll say, you just want to turn this into a Christian movement, or you want to turn this into another religious ritual, or whatever. Well, you know, and I guess my response to that is, well, you know, I don't believe Jesus was against rituals at all. He was only against the fact these people were just going through the motions. Their hearts were not in it. And I think that if people, you know, and Jesus established a ritual. He established the communion, you know, the communion ceremony. He also, and I realize that the book says that's become very rote and formulaic. That's true, but it doesn't have to be that way. The other thing is that Jesus also gave the apostles an ordination ceremony. So, you know, there are, I think Jesus knew the value of those things. I guess the question is, you know, do you really mean it? Is this really an expression, a collective expression of your personal faith? Or is it just something you're doing that you go through the motions doing? Because I've had you know, experiences. When it comes to rituals and ceremonies, I've had experiences that have been terribly boring and dry and dull, and I've had experiences that have been very meaningful. And I think it has to do primarily with, you know, how much are the people involved? How much does it really mean something to them? Because if it really means something to them, that's gonna be demonstrated. People are gonna see that these people really mean it.
Well, you know. I think that you're absolutely right. It was the meaningless aspect of rituals. If they're not meaningful anymore, then they're not meaningful. They're not of value. And you know, I've shared this story on the air before, but maybe I could share it again briefly. I went to St. Patrick's Cathedral in Uptown New York with a devoted Catholic. And when he saw that they were taking communion, he became very, very, very reverent. And we crept up to the front, and we sat in the pew, and we listened so intently, and he was just so intently involved in the communion that was taking place right then. And he leaned forward on the pew, on the seat, and he held the back of the pew in front of him, and he just was so intently listening, and I was just at his side. And he turned to me and said in a whisper, "You know, Paula, when I was a boy growing up in this church, we really believed we were taking on Christ." And all of a sudden, I realized that for him it was so meaningful.
Absolutely.
It was so meaningful. And who am I to take the meaning away from him? That had meaning. That was rich. That was a rich meaning. I got it. I've got it.
And you know, Paula, when I was, when I stopped, there was a time when I stopped reading the Urantia book. And by the way, let me also say that an obstacle for me for a while, not anymore, but for a while, the teachings on eugenics were a real obstacle for me. I could not, I couldn't accept it. I couldn't, you know, and I accept it now, but I couldn't for a while. It took me a long time to really reconcile that and really make sense of that. And that was one of the things that got me away from the Urantia book for about 10 years. But you know, when I was away from it, I flirted with Catholicism for a while. And, you know, when Catholics say that they're, you know, actually receiving the body and blood of Christ through the Eucharist, it's not so much an atonement thing for them. It's more of like, you know, they believe that the incarnation continues through the Eucharist, you know, through the communion ceremony, and that somehow Jesus is revealing himself in that piece of bread physically somehow. And, you know, of course, you know, you and I, we can look at that and say, well, that just doesn't make any logical sense. But, you know, there's something very beautiful about that for them. They really believe that the incarnation is continuing. And, you know,
And the Urantia book does say that is the believer's rendezvous, right?
That's right.
And if we let Jesus in us, right, Jesus himself says, "I'll stand at the door of men's hearts in Knock.
That's right.
They're opening up to him, and, you know, God bless them. I mean, if they read the Urantia book and they added even more meaning to their to that ritual because of the Urantia book, wow.
Right.
I love it. I think it's fantastic. We have a caller, Andre. 707, you're with us on The Cosmic Citizen.
Good morning, Paula. Good morning, Andre.
Good morning. Who's this?
Dr. Dave.
It's Dr. Dave, 707.
Hey.
Hey, what's happening?
Not too
doing
much.
Great. It's good
Pretty
to hear your beautiful baritone voice.
Well, thank you very much. The baby went with Mama here for the last 10 minutes, so I figured I'd call in. Sounds like my kind of show. I just wanted to say, I've been thinking about, like, what obstacles have I met in my progression of the understanding of the Urantia book, and the actual fact of the matter is I've met none. I've met not one obstacle. I've met every challenge that was designed, probably by me, for me to face in my spiritual progression wherever I met it. So everything that's happened since I've met the Urantia book, every facet of my relationship with this revelation that is not a book. It's in book format, but it's actually more equivalent to Jesus of Nazareth. And in my and the funny thing about using a book format is it's really different than any other revelation that came before. And the funny thing about a book is we only read books alone. You could project it on a wall and have a group reading, but let's face it, books were meant to be read by the individual. Unlike individuals, unlike Jesus, you can meet him in a group, you can meet him with others, but books, a book that is Jesus, that we only can meet alone. Nobody else's interpretation, nothing else matters between my relationship with this revelation, and everything I've met has been designed probably by me to help me in my spiritual progression.
Why do you, when you say that?
Thank you, everybody. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Hey, Dr. J, let me ask you. When you say this book is Jesus, what do you mean by that?
It means that, like, intellectually, we humans think of the book as a book, when indeed the Urantia book tells us it is a revelation that is equivalent to Jesus walking on earth. It's equivalent to Adam and Eve being here. It's equivalent to the Cal 100, which is my favorite little short term. And it's the equivalent of the Melchizedek teachings. It is an individual that has come to us in book form. It's the first revelation that hasn't been in a personality on the earth or personalities. It's the first revelation that is in this completely unique, unprecedented, even probably on other planets and other times, format of a book, you know? And
I agree.
It was done on purpose. It was part of God's design to make this revelation a book, and the book is individual. By definition, by nature, it is individual. And that's
God,
not coincidence.
You want to hear something funny about that? My friend Mo, when people ask him why did they send a book, he always tells them, well, when they went to get volunteers after what happened to Jesus, they couldn't get any volunteers to come down here. So they just
yes, but here we all are. I guess now's the time. So anyhow, I just want to thank everyone out there in the Urantia Book community, at the Foundation, at the Internet School. I want to thank Dorothy Elder especially, who's taught me more about the Urantia Book probably than any other individual as when I first found it. Well, and Martine Fierro, who introduced me to the book. And those two opinions and interpretations of the book, Martine's and Dorothy, couldn't be any more further apart. They're so far apart, they're touching on the backside. And thank you.
Well, and we have a question on the board that's been posed, and I agree with Crystalline. It's absolutely an important question. It's been a stumbling block for me, and it's about another religious doctrine, and that is the doctrine of reincarnation. And many people who may come to the book stumble over the fact that the book does not teach reincarnation. In fact, it refutes reincarnation. And I'll just share quickly, and maybe, Doc, you have a story about that, and maybe, Andre, you do too. I have found that I just go head on with it, and I tell reincarnationists, I say, look, even reincarnation teaches the story of the Ascended Masters. And I remember a conversation I had with a fellow in New York about this. It was at an expo. He came up to me, and he said, you know, I love the Urantia book, but I really can't reconcile this reincarnation thing. You know, my experience in life tells me, you know, everything points to this reincarnation thing, and I just can't reconcile it with the book. And I said, well, look, I said, you know, I said, you believe in reincarnation, then you believe also in the Ascended Masters. And he said, yes, we do. I said, okay, well, look at it this way then. I said, the Urantia book is here to get you off of the karmic wheel, right? I said, the Urantia book is here for those of us who are ready to ascend. If you're ready to ascend, the Urantia book is going to get you off, and we're going to ascend. And it's about the Ascension book, so think of it that way. It's for those of us who are ready to ascend. And he just totally got it. He said, oh, my gosh, that's it. And it was such a great moment because the guy was already reading the book. He read the whole book. He just could not reconcile that one thing. And again, sometimes it's just a matter of dealing with the people you're with and dealing with the doctrine that they're working with so that you can maybe add to another element that they didn't...
You're always so diplomatic and gracious about that kind of thing, Paula, more than I am, and I try to be. But, you know, when it comes to reincarnation, what I've said to people is, well, the book doesn't teach reincarnation, it teaches resurrection. But what you've described is even the way you put it, I think, is even more acceptable to people who believe in reincarnation. It's something that they're able, because you're using their language to describe what the book teaches, which I think is so helpful.
Well, it is, and you know, they're in really, when you think about it, what are they saying? Actually, they're saying, "Hey, look, I don't believe that you die and become perfect." Well, the Urantia book teaches that. The Urantia book teaches that you don't die and become perfect. You have to earn perfection, and it is no easy thing to earn. And you do have incarnations, and I often point this out to people. It does teach progressive incarnations.
Good point. But it's, good point.
It's as you ascend. You don't recycle, and I often use that word with them. I say you don't recycle. Your goal is not to recycle, right? Your goal is to ascend. The Ascendant Masters tell us the goal is ascension. So if you are recycling, you're missing the point. Something's not right. You've got to, you know, you want to ascend. And most reincarnationists, they really get that. So I've had better luck with people who believe in reincarnation than I have had with the atonement doctrine, actually.
Well, I've got to say that at UCLA a couple summers ago, I had probably my most intense conversation that weekend was with Justin and Judith over reincarnation, because there are a lot of UB readers that have a lot hard time. I mean, the UB pretty much in clear terms says there is no reincarnation, you know, that if God can make every snowflake unique, of course he can make every individual unique that ever is, ever was, on every world at every time. He's all that and more. So, but yet everyone has this feeling, this like feeling they can't reject, that they have lived other lives, that they have other experiences. And Dr. Dave does have his theory on this, and that is, as we are enlightened and we go from the personal consciousness into the collective consciousness, we become one with everything and everybody. And that gives us the feeling. And as we can only experience things at this point through our own individual perspectives, as we come into the collective consciousness and we relate, we have a relationship with other individuals, and then we experience them through our own perspective, it is inseparable that we've lived their life. We have lived their life in the collective consciousness because we are all one. But what happens is when we come back here, we can't quite make the connection that, because it's very true, we have lived that life in the collective consciousness. When we related to them, we lived their life, and we have that experience, and we have that memory back here, but we didn't actually live that life. We joined the collective consciousness, and then we do. So that's why we think we have reincarnation. It makes sense with what the UB says, Dr. Dave's theory on reincarnation. There you go.
And I love that explanation, and there's others I've heard that are, and I personally tend toward that. I think that we live in a, you know, this planet has a cosmic consciousness, and that every being that's ever lived here has added to that collective consciousness. And psychics, what they do is they tap into that. They tap into the consciousness of another being that's been on this world. Even if that being is gone now, they can tap into that consciousness. And, you know, I think there, you know, the Urantia book tells us that there are certain personality types that are inexplicably, you know, alike. And so if, you know, a lot of times what people are remembering may not be their own life or a past life, but the life of another. You know, I think there's a lot of ways to explain those experiences besides just reincarnation. So,
right. Hey, how are we doing on time now?
Well, we are out of time. We
That's
have 30.
What I figured.
So, well, thank you for letting me on here.
I just want to let everybody know what our show is next week. If things are going the way I think they are, we are going to have a show with my good friend Andre Rodatis, and it's going to be on defending the Urantia book.
The
know,
Order of Andres.
Yeah, that's right, two Andres. Yeah, we're going to be talking about is the Urantia book a revelation, and is you know, and is it and just does the Urantia book, does the worldview presented in the Urantia book provide life? Does it give an accurate diagnosis of the human condition and provide life transforming solutions to our human problems? And Andre is going to address that. Now, originally, I was going to have a debate with Andre and somebody else who didn't believe the book, but we got into some. Ran into some opposition from people about that. I may resurrect that in about 6 months. When at some point I'll make a case for that to people. But right now we're not going to do it.
Good radio, Andre. Do it. Do it.
Well, you're the first person that's told me that. I think it'd be good radio. Too.
All right.
I think it would be hot talk radio, man. That's what
do
I
do. we're all adults here. There aren't any kids, and if people are offended, it's their own ego, and they're presenting themselves a challenge to get over. So.
Oh, you are speaking my language, brother. You are preaching to the choir here. Amen.
Hey, Andre. I knew we'd hit middle ground somewhere.
Anyway, well, Dr. Dave, well, anyway, we are, but no, but I'm not going to do the debate right now. We will probably resurrect it eventually. But right now, we're just going to have Andre defend the book and give his defense as to why he thinks it is what it claims to be and what it can offer people. And so we're going to be doing that next week. And Paula, you're going to be out of town next week, right?
Yes, I am, Andre. I'm going to be in San Francisco for the General Council meeting, which maybe I'll get to meet you, Doc Dave.
You certainly will. You certainly will. I'll be there for all the good times, or at least a good portion of them, as much as I can get away for. How about that?
All right. Well, yeah, I'll be
I look forward
show,
to meeting
though,
you all.
I'll be doing that show with Andre, and maybe Larry will man the switchboard for us. So, anyway. God bless you, everybody, and we will talk to you next week. This has been a great show, and thank you for all of you who've called in, and I'm sure there are people who shared things on the board as well in terms of their own personal obstacles. So I thank you. I hope this has been edifying for everybody listening. Thanks everybody, for tuning in.
God bless.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. If you would like more information about the Urantia Book, or if you just have comments or questions, please feel free to email us at cosmiccitizen@xnet.com. That's cosmiccitizen@xnet.com. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.